And then she brought up the clay effortlessly, without trying, with that kind of quiet speed and total mastery, perfect control but no control, that one learns to see in a real master of an art. Well, I tried to follow her advice. I let go. And, of course, you can figure out what happened. The clay flew all over the studio. The pot collapsed. I mean, it was a total disaster. And then I remember her saying to me, well, you're not yet ready to give up control. You have to keep working at it until you learn to give up control. And I thought, there's the difference between that kind of intermediate mastery and the sublime mastery of the true master. That is, I, letting go of the control, failed. She didn't have to let go of the control because as a master, she had that kind of transcendent mode of control, which is not really at odds with material. Well, now let's think about this modes of mastery in the more general context of moral life or of action, that is, in which the skill of self-control is being focused not upon clay or upon piano or upon a horse, but being focused upon the object, which is the agent, himself or herself. Think, in other words, about control now as self-control, about trying to become master of our desires, trying to become the person who is in control of our impulses. Here, temperance is indeed the paradigm mode of that reflexive, self-directed skill. And this is to say, then, that the person who is temperate is a person who is master of himself or herself. Notice, then, that this can mean in control of or master of oneself in the intermediate manner that I sketched, in which I wasn't really master of the clay except by forcing them. That kind of mastery is a virtue that Plato and Aristotle have a special name for. They call it enkrateia, strength or fortitude or really being in control. But the distinction between the virtue of temperance that's being talked about in the Charmides and that lesser kind of control, which, as we'll see much later on in this course of lectures when we talk about Aristotle, became central to Aristotle's moral vision, that distinction is a distinction between self-mastery in the sense, as it were, of a kind of forced or bonded self-restraint and self-control on the one hand, and on the other hand, a self-mastery in the sense of the free and effortless guiding of the self. So there's a great and critical difference, then, between a theory that sees self-mastery as a kind of self-control, which is at struggle with itself, that is, the self in struggle with its own self, and a theory which sees it as a virtue that is ideally transcendent of such control. For on one view, self-mastery is the virtue of a person in conflict with their desires, and on the other view, it may be rare that temperance is fully exemplified in this sense, but in its highest form, it's the virtue of a person harmonious, a person who is at one with himself or herself. In the lesser kind of self-control, the self, as it were, becomes its own object and thus alienated and divided from itself. And later on in the dialogue, the Charmides, there's an extraordinary moment in the dialogue, in the argument, in which Socrates leads the other participant in the dialogue, Critias, through a cunningly fallacious argument that moves from the understanding of self as one's knowledge of oneself to an understanding which is of itself, a knowledge of knowledge. And here, as so often happens in the dialogues, an extraordinary kind of fallacy sheds light, and things somehow work out in the typically mad and witty Platonic fashion. People make all the wrong moves, but the argument, sort of like an oracle, relentlessly finds its way to its proper conclusion. For it turns out that for the elaboration of temperance, the real virtue of temperance, nothing works better than the concept of a knowledge which is, as it were, objectless, pure, and transparent. Temperance, as it turns out in this dialogue, is precisely the virtue of a general and unself-conscious self-mastery and self-possession,